and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Senate candidate and former mining company CEO Don Blankenship, who spent a year in prison for his role in the deaths of 29 miners, appears to be surging in the West Virginia Senate race in light of an overtly racist and xenophobic television ad his campaign has been airing this week. Blankenship says that if elected, he will create jobs for Americans, not for, quote, China people, unquote, and he excoriates Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, whose wife is Chinese-American, as, quote, Cocaine Mitch. Next, Oliver North, the central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s and now a Fox News contributor, was named president of the National Rifle Association yesterday. It was North who illegally arranged for arms sales to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and then used the proceeds to illegally purchase weapons for the Contra rebels, who were fighting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Then, peace and anti-torture groups have begun arriving on Capitol Hill to protest the nomination of Gina Haspel to be CIA director. Haspel was integral to the CIA's torture program during the George W. Bush administration. She headed a secret prison, oversaw torture sessions, and later destroyed videotaped evidence of the torture. And then, a new report in the Observer newspaper and New Yorker magazine says that unidentified people connected to the Trump administration hired a private Israeli intelligence company last year to dig up embarrassing information, primarily sexual in nature, on Democrats who had supported the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, all in an effort to discredit it. This Israeli firm is the same one allegedly hired by movie mogul Harvey Weinstein to discredit women who accused him of sexual improprieties. And finally, President Trump is sending a plan to Congress that calls for cutting $15 billion in previously approved spending. Almost half the cuts would come from two accounts within the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, while another $800 million would come from within the Obamacare program. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to West Virginia. Senate candidate and former mining company CEO Don Blankenship, who spent a year in prison for his role in the deaths of 29 miners, appears to be surging in the West Virginia Senate race in light of an overtly racist television ad his campaign has been airing this week. Blankenship says that if elected, he will create jobs for Americans, not for, quote, China people, unquote. And he excoriates Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, whose wife is Chinese-American, as, quote, Cocaine Mitch. We're joined from Morgantown, West Virginia, by Frank Arriott. He's a community organizer, and we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News political analyst and the producer of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to be here.
Frank, let's start with you. We've been following this race very closely. We look at every poll. We talk about it at least once a week on the show. It looked a week ago like Blankenship was fading pretty severely. The latest polls had him falling to something like 16 or 17% of the vote. And now not only do his internal polls show him leading this race, and we should say the voting is today, but also the internal polls of his opponents show him leading this race. Are we looking at a Blankenship upset today?
You know, it certainly seems that way, at least with the Republican primary. With Don Blankenship, he's been trying to sell this narrative that he was not to blame for the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, that it was actually MSHA, the Mine Safety Health Administration.
Right.
You know, and on top of that, with his attacks against his opponent, Evan Jenkins, you know, it seems like, at least on the Republican side, they're seeming to buy that narrative. But I don't see him winning in the November election. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, there's been upsets before in West Virginia history.
Sure. Walter, I'd like to play this clip from the Blankenship television advertisement. We've mentioned, like I said before on this show, the fact that Blankenship is spending his own money and lots of it. The Washington Post said today that he's spending $100,000 a day, at least he has for the past week in the run-up to today's primary. But he's been running this racist ad in the Washington, D.C. market. It's crazy expensive, and it's very offensive. Let's listen to a clip.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Mitch's swamp people are now running false negative ads against me. They are also childishly calling me despicable and mentally ill. The war to drain the swamp and create jobs for West Virginia people has begun. I will beat Joe Manchin and ditch Cocaine Mitch for the sake of the kids.
So he throws in Cocaine Mitch there at the end. With,
for the sake of the kids.
With no explanation. For the sake of children. Won't anybody think of the children? And this attack on McConnell's wife, who also happens to be the Secretary of Transportation, it just came out of the blue. Now, Blankenship says that Mitch McConnell has received $10 million from China people or from his China family. What that means, or what he means, is Elaine Chao, Mrs. Mitch McConnell, her parents died, and they were very successful business people, and so she inherited $10 million. That's what that means. Frank, tell us, does this ad resonate in West Virginia?
Yes and no. It resonates in the sense that those ads are Trump supporters, you know, because Trump had one of his biggest wins here in the state. It resonates more with them, this xenophobic message, you know, America for Americans, and you know, which actually just means, you know, America for white people, for white, you know, Anglo-Saxon people. It resonates with them the most. You know, there is this big idea here that the problem is not business that's leaving West Virginia or the lack of pay or benefits. The problem is foreigners, you know. So that seems to me it's targeting more towards them. You know, especially the China, you know, there's this big, I guess you can say, boogeyman concept of China, that China is this massive, you know, specter, no pun intended, but this specter that's coming and haunting the United States and going to just destroy the U.S. working class, which, you know, is not true. So it seems like he's gearing more towards them and gearing more towards that Trump base, which he's relying on to get him elected.
So, Walter, what does that mean for a general election in West Virginia? Let's make an assumption here that Don Blankenship wins this race today and then goes up against Joe Manchin. Now, Joe Manchin's not just the incumbent senator, but he was also a very popular two-term governor of West Virginia. Then what? What do the people of West Virginia make out of that choice?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just that ad is unspeakably racist and xenophobic. You know, like the fact that you know, Don Blankenship, who many people say, you know, he was responsible personally for the deaths of, you know, those over 20 miners who exploded in the mine that he owned, that was, you know, in flagrant violation and repeated violation of mine safety standards, right? I mean, this guy who, you know, is responsible for such terrible crimes against working people in West Virginia, coming along and saying, you know what, who your enemy is? China. I mean, it's so outrageous. And, you know, maybe it will be enough to win a three-way Republican primary, right? I mean, that's when you really, like, go through all the different qualifications. It's a pretty small sliver of the population. When it comes to, you know, the November election, I think that while Joe Manchin might be, you know, not particularly popular among the state's voters who went, you know, overwhelmingly for Trump in the 2016 election, I think he will most likely defeat Blankenship if Blankenship is the Republican nominee. The other story, I think, that sort of is papered over with the electoral debate is the number of people in West Virginia who just don't vote anymore. You
right.
know, like a lot of the Trump phenomena, of course, was people who, you know, have been suffering from, you know, say, deindustrialization.
Yeah, in fact, Donald flipping. Trump, he won by his biggest margin in the whole country in West Virginia.
Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of that is people, you know, who were affected by those trends flipping to vote for Trump. But a lot of it, and there's, you know, different studies that have come to different conclusions about, you know, exactly how much, a lot of it is people who were voting for Democrats just dropping out of the electorate altogether. So I think that could be an issue that Joe Manchin faces in the November election that makes Blankenship more competitive.
And Frank, in the event that Blankenship loses this race, what does that mean for the general election in West Virginia?
Essentially, if he loses, that would give more of an upper hand to Joe Manchin. You know, like I said earlier, because of the fact that he is trying to win over the the Trump electorate. Even though Blankenship is hated in this state, as Walter was saying, a lot of people have dropped out voting. So, you know, the people that are going to vote against Blankenship and Joe Manchin are going to be either people that are actually supportive of Blankenship or people that want to defeat Blankenship no matter what and vote for Manchin. You know, Manchin has his own opposition right now within the Democratic Party with Paula Jean Swearingen, but it doesn't seem like she's actually going to gain any momentum because of the fact that the Democratic voters are scared that Blankenship might actually win.
Right. And Walter, Blankenship has been very clear in interviews that he is more Trumpian than Trump. But in fact, Donald Trump has been to West Virginia specifically to campaign against Don Blankenship. Got about 45 seconds left. What do you make of that? Do the voters of West Virginia care who is more Trumpian than Donald Trump?
I don't think that. I mean, there's a segment that cares, but you know what Donald Trump's endorsement, I think, of, you know, anybody but Blankenship means is that they have serious concerns about retaining control of the Senate after the midterm election. You know, they might even be worried about the House as well, and so there's you know, active intervention from the White House and from the National Republican Party apparatus into races to make sure that, you know, the most electable quote unquote candidates win. So, you know, it reflects, I think, this broader concern that the Republicans have in terms of the Senate.
Yeah, this is going to be fascinating. I can't wait to watch the returns on the news this evening. We were joined from Morgantown, West Virginia by Frank Arriott. He's a community organizer there. And we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek, who is the producer of the show and a Sputnik News political analyst. Stay tuned. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Oliver North, the central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s and now a Fox News contributor, was named president of the National Rifle Association yesterday. It was North who illegally arranged for arms sales to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and then used the proceeds to illegally purchase weapons for the Contra rebels who were fighting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. We're joined from Washington by Joe Loria. He's a journalist and political commentator and author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And he's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, who broke the Iran-Contra scandal. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Joe, what are we supposed to make of this? Is this some kind of a PR move? I noticed that today, NRA CEO Wayne Delapierre or LaPierre, whatever his name is, compared Oliver North to Charlton Heston and said that North would lead the NRA into this new era of growth.
Charlton Heston, by the way, does have cold dead hands now.
Yes, he does indeed. What's left of them.
I thought you were going to ask whether this was some kind of joke.
Well, you know what? When I first saw the breaking news, I thought it was a joke. And then I had to click on it to see if it was or if it was for real. And unfortunately, it was for real.
Yeah, well, think about it. He ran guns to Iran, right?
Yes, he did.
He's familiar with guns. And therefore, it makes sense in a way. You have to see that he's still culturally, to a pretty large segment of the population, unfortunately, still a cultural hero. For openly and brazenly defying the Constitution in Iran-Contra, the very Constitution that these gun advocates repeatedly cite for their right to hold a gun. So they're selectively citing the U.S. Constitution. North is, he's not the actor Charlton Heston was, but he's probably as crazy a gun nut as Heston.
You know, very few people will know what Iran-Contra is, and we want to talk about it real quickly and maybe Oliver North's role in it. He was then with the National Security Council when they conceived of the scheme.
Yeah, he was actually a low-level functionary on the National Security Council. He was a lieutenant colonel, which is the equivalent in the civil service of a GS-14. Most people are GS-15s or higher at the National Security Council. So in the greater scheme of things during the Reagan administration, he was a nobody.
Joe Loria is our guest, and Joe has become the new editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, as we mentioned in the introduction. And Robert Perry was the person, more than any other person, who broke the Iran-Contra scandal that finally resulted in Oliver North being prosecuted and found guilty, although he was you know, then exonerated by the president. Let's listen to an RT interview with Robert Perry in 2012 on the 25th anniversary of the Iran-Contra scandal. Let's listen, and then Joe Lauria will comment.
Well, the work I was doing with the Associated Press was more focused on Oliver North. He had this dual portfolio. One side was for Central America, and one side was for counterterrorism. I was focused more on his Central America side, and in covering that and dealing with where the money was coming from to fund the Contras, we stumbled upon his network, which was this essentially extra-legal operation being run out of the White House to get money and weapons to the Contras. Now, later on, it turns out that some of that money was being diverted from these arms sales to Iran.
It's an amazing story. Again, this was just 7 years after the Iranian Revolution. Today, Donald Trump said the U.S. was leaving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal. But back in the mid-80s, you had the Reagan administration at least collaborating at one level with the government in Iran. Go ahead, Joe Lauria. Tell us the significance of this story and how crazy it was.
Well, I'd like to retell a story at the memorial that was held for Bob Perry in Arlington, Virginia on the 14th of April. Jill Abramson was one of the speakers. Jill Abramson, former executive editor of the New York Times, was a close neighbor of Bob and his wife, Diane. And she was, at the time of the Iran-Contra scandal, the Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. And she got up there and said that she remembers sitting around a dinner table one day, and Bob was going on about this crazy colonel in the basement of the White House selling guns to Iran and giving them money to the Contras. She said she thought he was crazy. So that tells you right there that the corporate media didn't take seriously what he was saying. And then I have to repeat what Bob with Brian Barger, who was his partner, who doesn't get as much credit as Bob does. He had many of the shared bylines on these major Iran-Contra stories, particularly about Oliver North. And he talked about how he met Bob in the mid-80s, and they met a wall of resistance to these stories from their editors. They even turned in one story about all of the Oliver North network. They had cited more than two dozen sources, including aides to Oliver North, Contra leaders, U.S. law enforcement officials. The editors sent the story back, and written across the top was, "Can't you get North to just confess?" That was from the AP bureau chief. Then they turned in another story 9 months, working on it after 9 months, about the Contras involved in the drug smuggling. And the editing went on, and that story was finally crushed. And it only was published because it inadvertently got out on the Spanish language AP wire. So once it was out in Spanish, they had to put it out in English. And it was at that time, Brian Barger said that the bureau chief they learned of AP, who had been sending that story back, was meeting privately with Oliver North because they were both trying to get Terry Anderson, the AP reporter held hostage in Lebanon at that time, to get him released. And Bob, although he was sympathetic to Terry Anderson's plight, Brian Barger, the idea of that conflict of interest was too much for him. That eventually led Bob to leave AP. He left Newsweek because he ran up against resistance from editors who said that the stories weren't good for the country. And then he eventually began Consortium News, which is where mainstream reporters can publish stuff that's being suppressed in the mainstream and the corporate media. So Bob was central to, obviously, the Iran-Contra story. He also later broke October surprise stories regarding Iran, and he never got enough credit for that, but he started Consortium News, and we're all grateful for that.
You know, one of the things we should remember, too, is the Iran-Contra scandal was so serious that it led to myriad indictments. I mean, people at the top levels of government were talking about the National Security Advisor, for example, being indicted, and then attempting suicide later on.
Casper Weinberger, no?
And Casper Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, was indicted. Now, they were all pardoned eventually by George H.W. Bush.
But convicted,
because these were real national security crimes.
And Joe, what happened is, because of mass popular opposition to the funding of the Contras, which was the National Guardsmen of the former Somoza dictatorship, been overthrown by the Sandinistas, led by Daniel Ortega and others in 1979, because Congress cut off Reagan's ability to send money directly to those Contras to carry out this bloody civil war in Nicaragua. This was an act to defy Congress, and it's rare that Congress does something like this, but you can see the determination of the executive branch and these people like Oliver North who were committing crimes and doing anything they could to get around the popular will of elected officials who said no to that kind of criminal undertaking in Nicaragua.
I think this was maybe the greatest scandal in U.S. history, and there's so many to choose from, so it's hard to be certain about that. I think it's certainly a much more serious crime than even Watergate. They absolutely violated the Constitution. The most important part of it, the separation of powers, where the Congress allocates money and the executive branch executes policy, and they didn't like what Congress had done, and they were so hell-bent on overthrowing the Sandinistas with these Contra revolution of the Contras to get rich landowners back in power after a popular uprising, that they were willing to go behind the back of Congress and trade with so-called enemy. If you recall, Reagan and other leaders would repeatedly say, we would not negotiate with terrorists, and that's or the Iranian government, this government that called for death to America. And here they were selling arms to them through Israel as middlemen, to get that money that Congress rightfully and legally refused to send to this counter-revolution in Nicaragua. And it was an enormous scandal. And Bob Perry's role in that, again, is not acknowledged, because the scandal is not acknowledged to this day as being as huge as it was, in my view.
Ronald Reagan called the Contras the moral equivalent of our founding fathers.
Oh, I remember that. They were freedom fighters. Remember the whole debate between rebels and freedom fighters?
Yeah.
And they were Reagan's freedom
fighters.
And
these people were the National Guard of a bloody military dictatorship. Now, of course, some people will say, well, the founding fathers had a lot of blood on their hands. Of course, they were slave owners and so on. So somebody might say, yeah, they're trying to bring slavery back to Nicaragua. But the point was, or my point is, that Reagan was trying to put these people on a pedestal, and they were the bloody gangsters of a bloody military dictatorship that was overthrown by a justified armed struggle. That was the Sandinista Revolution. But America, under Reagan, and even before that under Carter, saw the Sandinistas as the enemy because they were going to be independent of the United States, whereas Somoza, no matter how bloody his regime was going to be an extension of American power and do the bidding of American companies.
Well, Reagan saying that openly shows you how comfortable he was with what he thought would be public support for what they were doing. This is not a secret war. He openly said he wanted to overthrow the Sandinistas and back the Contras. It was reporters like Bob Perry that gave him trouble, and all of his administration. But there was AP going along again. Once more, we see collusion between corporate news executives and government policy, in this case, a highly illegal policy. They didn't want these stories out. They tried to suppress them. And it was because of Bob's doggedness that we learned about Iran-Contra. But again, it's gone down in terms of awareness, and it shouldn't, in my opinion.
You know, I want to, in our last 30 seconds, I want to mention one thing. Bob Perry, when he was in working for the AP, interviewed me in June of 1983 when we were organizing one of the first big mass protests against the funding of the Contras. And it turned out to be a demonstration of about 15,000, and it was at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, big right-wing mobilization against us. But at that time, the mainstream media wouldn't cover us. This one guy, who I had never heard of, Bob Perry, came and met with me in a restaurant in DuPont Circle, and he wrote a story, and it wasn't that long, but it was AP. And suddenly that story went everywhere, and suddenly our demonstration got legs. And it was like that guy, Bob Perry, didn't have to do it, but he did do it. That's what also made him unique.
Great story, Brian. Never heard that one.
He did it because it was the right thing to do. We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Joe Loria. Joe's a journalist and a political commentator, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. He's also the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, which was founded by the late Robert Perry, and it was Bob who broke the Iran-Contra scandal. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Peace and anti-torture groups have been arriving on Capitol Hill to protest the nomination of Gina Haspel to be the new CIA director. Haspel was integral to the CIA's torture program during the George W. Bush administration. She headed a secret prison, oversaw torture sessions, and later destroyed videotaped evidence of the torture. We're joined from Capitol Hill by Jeremy Varon. He's a professor at the New School in New York, and he's an anti-torture activist. He's also helping to lead those protests today. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy, tell us what's happening today and tomorrow on Capitol Hill to oppose Gina Haspel's nomination.
Well, on Wednesday, Ms. Haspel has her confirmation hearings at the Senate Hart Building, and then she'll be before a panel of senators questioned probably for a period of hours, possibly both in open and closed session, about her qualifications for the job. And a big topic that will come up is her involvement in torture, as you indicated. And a group of us will be gathering outside the Hart office building with an unequivocal message that Haspel is unqualified and unworthy of the honor of head of the CIA by virtue of her role in immoral and illegal torture policies.
Jeremy, the press is all over the map on this Haspel nomination. You know, this is an issue that's very important to me personally, and so I make sure that I'm as well-informed, I think, as is possible. But today's press went from CNN saying it's anybody's guess if Haspel's going to pass the vote in the committee, and certainly it's anybody's guess whether she'll have enough votes on the floor of the Senate to win the office. But then you have other outlets, not even really right-wing outlets, but things like Politico saying she's got the votes, she's going to win it. Are you picking anything up there on Capitol Hill? Are you talking to senators or staff members? Can you enlighten us at all on where people stand?
Yeah, I mean, I can't illuminate, unfortunately, the likely vote. I mean, this will be a true Capitol Hill nail-biter.
Yeah.
And, you know, as was widely reported, she offered on Friday to withdraw her nomination. And the Trump administration, including President Trump, it appears, reached out to her to ask her to stay in. And then one could plausibly assume that they wouldn't have put her up for nomination if they hadn't whipped the votes to virtually guarantee that she will pass. But I don't think anybody would say with 100% certainty that they know she'll pass. She has to get a majority of the Senate. A couple of Republicans presumably will vote against her, but at least a couple of Democrats might vote for her. And then I'm afraid that even some of her Democratic critics will cave if she says, you know, all the right things, so to speak, in her confirmation hearings. So, you know, it's a true case where I don't think the outcome is obvious to anyone, and we'll simply have to see.
You know, it really says a lot about where we've gone as a country when the CIA director designate goes to Capitol Hill and has to promise to individual senators that she won't break the law if they vote for her. I can't remember any such thing happening with any other proposed CIA director, at least not in the 36 years that I've been in Washington. Have you ever heard of anything like that before?
No, I mean, for some perspective on this, Chris Anders, who's a lobbyist for the ACLU, said in a quote, you know, we are on the verge of the Senate for the first time ever confirming somebody who had an operational role in torture. It is a remarkable circumstance, as you indicate. And then it's been very interesting to follow all of the rhetoric supporting her, the argument that we should vote for her because she's a woman is ridiculous. Women need to be held to the same legal and moral standards as men, you know, obviously. And then I heard Barry McCaffrey a couple of days ago, you know, a general, decorated general, very admirably admit that the United States tortured. It went right up to the office of the president and the vice president. DOD was implicated in it as well. But his argument is if we punish her for this, we have to punish the entire, you know, Bush administration for a crime in which many, many people were complicit. And so it's a real, you know, dilemma. What do you do when the torture permeated, you know, such high ranks of government? And I think it, you know, it sends the wrong signal to say because everyone's guilty, therefore nobody is guilty and nobody should pay a price. And that's what they're essentially saying if they, you know, nominate her or confirm her rather.
And I would disagree with McCaffrey. I understand if you are a journeyman level CIA officer and your leadership tells you that the Justice Department has approved this program, that it's not torture, and that you have to do it, and then you go and do it. I don't agree with that, but I understand it. But what about the CIA officers who were under Gina Haspel's authority, who went beyond what the Justice Department had approved and who killed people that we had in custody? They killed prisoners who were being interrogated. No one has ever been brought to justice for killing anyone during those interrogations. And there's a big difference between Gina Haspel not getting a job because of her background and Gina Haspel being prosecuted. She's not being prosecuted. I fear for the country where we've crossed a line that makes it okay to have committed crimes against humanity or war crimes, and not only for it to be deemed all right a decade and a half later, but you actually get promoted to the point where you become the director of the CIA. It's the message that we're sending to the American people, to CIA officers, to our friends and allies abroad, even to our enemies, that this kind of behavior is not just all right, but it's all right and you're going to get promoted and rewarded for it.
No, I mean, I think you captured things perfectly. And then I would add to that Trump's tweet where he said, essentially, the Democrats don't like her because she's soft on terror. So the implication there is that because she tortured, she's more qualified for the job. Most people are trying to minimize her role, rationalize it away, dissemble and dissimulate, and sort of define down her role in all of this. But Trump appears to be proud of it. And it's possible that torture could again become state policy. It might not be likely. There might be pushback in the CIA. Lawyers might advise them against it, but you can't rule it out. And we have a president who is on public record being pro-torture, insisting that it works. There's no evidence for that. Insisting that it makes America safer. There's no evidence for that, you know, and so on and so forth.
You're exactly right. There is no such evidence. Getting into the politics of this, one of the things that frightens me the most is we've already seen the likes of Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, gushing over Gina Haspel as the two of them were coming out of his office following a meeting yesterday. We really don't know where Dianne Feinstein stands. I mean, she's complained, I suppose, about the CIA's lack of transparency around this nomination, but we really don't know how she's going to vote. And then there are other Democrats in the Senate running for re-election in states that Donald Trump won, people like Joe Donnelly in Indiana, John Tester in Montana, Senator Nelson in Florida, even Claire McCaskill in Missouri, who was a very close political ally of Barack Obama, all playing with the idea of voting yes. We saw this during the Pompeo nomination as Secretary of State, and we're seeing a repeat now with Gina Haspel. So I fear what's happening.
Right. There should be a vote based on conscience and an affirmation of the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. It should not be a vote based on political calculation. But as you indicated, a lot of people are making political calculations. And unfortunately, in certain districts, you know, the politics of torture play well. We don't see this, you know, at our demonstration as a question of left versus right, Democrat versus Republican. This is a question of right versus wrong, and whether the United States is actually a country of laws that, you know, has some fidelity to its beautiful founding principles, or if it is a country that can excuse itself war crimes, even as it condemns war crimes and other human rights violations and the behavior of other nations.
Jeremy, Reuters came out with a poll in 2016 indicating that fully two-thirds of Americans support a torture program. What is wrong with our country? Because we never saw those numbers pre-9/11.
I'm aghast and I puzzle over this. As I think we've discussed before on the program, I think that a lot of Americans believe that national strength depends on the ability to inflict violence on one's enemies. Let's not forget that those who are tortured post 9/11 are almost exclusively Muslims. Muslims as a whole have been demonized. There's a wide assumption that they have some intrinsic disposition towards, you know, terrorism, and that they're not worthy in the first instance of basic protections of human rights and the rule of law. So I think it's a combination of systemic racism, fear, insecurity, paranoia, and the sense that to be safe and proud and strong as a nation, you have to be tough and even brutal towards your perceived enemies. And then, of course, there's others, including in the military establishment, who say true national strength is based on commitment to democracy, the rule of law, and all kinds of noble principles that the United States claims to stand for. So a battle for the soul of the nation is going on at many fronts, right? All at once. It's very dizzying times, but we can't lose the thread of this important struggle.
We can't. We can't give up the fight, but we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Capitol Hill by Jeremy Varin. He is a professor at the New School in New York and an anti-torture activist, and he's helping to lead those protests against Gina Haspel today. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A new report in the Observer newspaper and New Yorker magazine says that unidentified people connected to the Trump administration hired a private Israeli intelligence company last year to dig up embarrassing information, primarily sexual in nature, on Democrats who had supported the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, all in an effort to discredit it. This Israeli firm is the same one allegedly hired by movie mogul Harvey Weinstein to discredit women who had accused him of sexual improprieties. We're joined from Santiago, Chile by Whitney Webb. She's a journalist and a staff writer for Mint Press News. Whitney, it's been a long time. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me back on.
Whitney, what are we supposed to make of this revelation? Is this a serious thing? Is this a threat to our democracy? Or is this just something that we ought to come to expect from Donald Trump and the people around Donald Trump?
Well, I think it shows the desperation of the Trump administration in terms of its efforts to justify what it's been trying to do in shredding the Iran deal, even though Iran has been found to be in full compliance with the agreement since it was established.
Yeah, I that's what the press is saying too. Ronan Farrow did not break this story. The Observer did. It ran also in The Guardian. But Ronan Farrow is the one who really dug down into it and found some details that nobody else had found.
Right. Well, he also dug into Black Cube in terms of their connection to Harvey Weinstein, as you referenced. And he actually said that when he wrote about that story, he was more afraid of having written that story than he was when he had written about, stuff on the Afghanistan war and things like that. He was more intimidated by these figures than he was by that.
That's absolutely right. And it's because a company like Black Cube, it's an Israeli company, it answers to no one. And we really don't know what it does or who it's working for. And we don't know what they're willing to do to people standing in their way. And I think that's exactly what the people who hire companies like this are looking for.
Right. I think that's definitely true. I also would like to point out that beyond Harvey Weinstein, Black Cube has been involved in some other scandals in recent years. I mean, since it was founded, relatively recently in 2011. So, for example, Black Cube had been hired to hack the personal data, including medical records and private emails of Nigerian President Buhari prior to his election. And this is significant because Buhari is relatively disliked by Israeli officials because he vocally has supported Palestine and the two-state solution, which is a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict the Israeli government rejects. And it's also taken out work on behalf of Israeli billionaire and blood diamond merchant Benny Steinmetz, who was under investigation in several countries for corruption. And though it's unclear who hired Black Cube in that instance, some of its operatives were caught breaking into an office of a prosecutor in Romania and trying to steal case files from the office of the prosecutor who was targeting Steinmetz in an attempt to weaken the case against him. So, they do a lot of things, work for a lot of people that are rather, they do the dirty work for a lot of people in the private sector and for some foreign governments as well.
Well, let me ask you specifically about this JCPOA issue. The Guardian reported that private investigators were trying to, quote, get dirt, unquote, on Ben Rhodes, who for a while was one of Joe Biden's national security advisors and ended up becoming the deputy national security advisor on the National Security Council under President Obama. And also Colin Call, who was a deputy assistant to President Obama. These are not elected officials. They don't have a vote on the JCPOA. So why target them?
I think it has to do with the fact that they were directly involved in negotiating the Iran deal. And in Ben Rhodes' case, it has to do with a comment that he made to the New York Times in 2016, where he claimed that he had tried to create a quote, echo chamber in the media by talking to inexperienced journalists in order to sway public opinion towards support for the Iran deal, which was sort of jumped on here as possibility that Ben Rhodes may have behaved unethically and that the dirt could be dug up on him in order to, you know, justify what the Trump administration has been trying to do in terms of shredding the Iran deal. You know, they're looking for something, you know, a justification for why they need to shred the deal, even though the decision to shred the deal has already been made. They need sort of, you know, reasons for that that are publicly acceptable.
We have to put this into perspective, too. During the time that Obama had decided to enter into the negotiations for the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear arms deal, the Republicans and others in the U.S. political foreign policy establishment went crazy. They actually invited Netanyahu, let's remember, to speak to both houses of Congress so that he could attack and trash the negotiations of the sitting U.S. president.
That's right.
And so you had the Republicans cheering on Netanyahu, trashing Obama at the U.S. Congress. I mean, like I think perhaps an unprecedented moment just from the point of view of international diplomacy and U.S. diplomacy. And now you had the Trump administration, apparently, shortly after Trump took office and visited Israel, more investigations were launched by this private company to dig up dirt on U.S. officials so that they could smear them and thus try to discredit the Iran nuclear arms deal in preparation for what we've known for weeks was Donald Trump's intention to leave the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So, Whitney, we have foreign governments meddling in the United States in all kinds of way.
Imagine.
And this is, in fact, the Israeli government. And you never hear it in the mainstream U.S. media that the Israeli government is colluding with Trump or other politicians to interfere and affect U.S. policy. But this is really a black bags job. It's a dirty psych ops. It's quite amazing. But perhaps that's not unusual. What do you think?
No, I wouldn't call it unusual at all, considering that the involvement of the Israeli government in U.S. politics is bipartisan and very far-reaching. I think in terms of this case, it's important to point out, you know, what is really one of the driving forces behind Trump's bid to shred the Iran deal. Who's also one of Netanyahu's biggest backers, which is Shadan Adelson, who's the Zionist billionaire who has some really dangerous U.S. foreign policy views on Iran. And he's also a very close associate of John Bolton and actually helped get John Bolton installed as national security advisor. So, for instance, when the Iran deal was being negotiated, Adelson actually advocated for a U.S. nuclear attack on Iran without provocation, just so the U.S. could, quote, impose its demands on Iran from a position of strength. And he has also said that any sort of diplomatic engagement with Iran is the worst negotiating tactic he could ever imagine. So, I mean, this is what the man who is a big funder of Trump's and has been, you know, was also influential in getting the Trump administration to move the embassy, the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
In fact, he paid for it out of his pocket.
Yes, he's been very intimately involved in this. He's also, you know, the one who's really pushed for the Iran deal to be totally destroyed. So it's important to remember that these are, you know, just some of the foreign policy views of the man who wants this to happen. And, you know, the involvement of Black Cube shows here is that there is an effort to at least give superficial legitimacy to the U.S. government's plan to shred the deal. And that Netanyahu's recent presentation on Iran's so-called atomic archive was also part of that.
Yeah, that's the voice of Whitney Webb. Whitney is a journalist and a staff writer for Mint Press News. We're talking to Whitney from Santiago, Chile. What comes next, Whitney? Obviously, the Israeli government opposed this deal. Israeli private company digging up dirt on behalf of the Trump administration, paid for by perhaps Trump aides or Trump supporters to dig up dirt on those in the Obama administration who were responsible for helping to facilitate the Joint Comprehensive Plan. Where do you think this is going? Are we heading towards a real sort of major confrontation between the United States and Iran?
Well, I know that Israel is actively preparing for that sort of conflict. As to whether the U.S. supports them is going to be the ultimate test of how much pull Israel actually has in U.S. politics. But Iran is always going to be a focus of, you know, Israel because, well, for several reasons, the first of which is that they're a major supporter of Palestine and the Palestinian cause, which, you know, Israel is obviously opposed to. And they also, Iran has become a regional economic power even when it was under heavy sanctions, which actually forced it to diversify its economy. And it's been doing really well in terms of it, its natural gas exports and things like that. So we're going to continue to see Israel and as well as some of the Gulf markets that have been increasingly allied with Israel continue to go after them because they are really the only country in the Middle East that is economically resilient enough and powerful enough to continue resist the regional ambitions of Israel. And they're also, you know, have also expressed that they're relatively intent on doing so.
I want to get back to Black Cube for a second. This is something that really bothers me personally. I want to read a short passage from today's Guardian newspaper. Talking about Black Cube, it says, among other things they were looking at were personal relationships, and this is specific to Ben Rhodes and to Carl Kahl, personal relationships, any involvement with Iran-friendly lobbyists, and if they had benefited personally or politically from the peace deal. Investigators were also apparently told to contact prominent Iranian Americans as well as pro-deal journalists from the New York Times, MSNBC, The Atlantic, Vox website, and Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, among others, who had frequent contact with Rhodes and Kahl in an attempt to establish whether they had violated any protocols by sharing sensitive intelligence. Now, that has an Espionage Act prosecution written all over it.
Yes, I thought the same thing, actually, when I read it. It definitely suggests that these actually may have been related to efforts to try and go after Rhodes and Kahl after the fact for allegedly leaking classified or sensitive info, which is really troubling given how the Trump administration has treated suspected leakers.
Yeah, I mean, we saw with the prosecution of Reality Winner that that this is a continuation of the Obama administration's policy of using the Espionage Act to prosecute political cases. It looks like that's what the Trump administration was preparing to do in this case as well. Well, I hate to say it, but we're out of time. We were joined from Santiago, Chile by Whitney Webb. She's a journalist and a staff writer for Mint Press News. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump is sending a plan to Congress that calls for cutting $15 billion in previously approved spending. Almost half the cuts would come from two accounts within the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, while another $800 million would come from a program within Obamacare. We're joined from Bennington, Vermont by Mary Garish. She's an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me, and thank you for having this show.
Well, we are very pleased to do it. And actually, my first question, I think I'm going to try to cut directly to the chase. Why in the world would Donald Trump try to balance the budget, or not even balance the budget, but reduce expenditures on the backs of children? Because that's what this comes down to.
That's exactly what it comes down to. And that's exactly what he's doing. And that is exactly what he wants. Because what he wants to do is to make sure that he can repeal the ACA in its entirety. And don't get me wrong, it's not my favorite healthcare system because obviously we know I would all prefer single-payer universal care. However, what he is doing is he is trying to make the current system fail so that the insurance companies can further commodify our health care. And honestly, I know this sounds really drastic, but I believe that he and a lot of the people that are his supporters feel like, oh, well, if you're so poor that you can't afford health care, maybe it would be better for society if you just died.
You know, we see memes like that on Facebook, on Twitter, and they're meant to be dark jokes. But there's an underlying truth to it. I'm looking at something in Education Week magazine, scholarly journal, you know, not scholarly, but a journal dedicated to the to education. And it says here that the CHIP program, the total budget for the CHIP program is only $15.6 billion. And Donald Trump is proposing cutting that in half. Now, this would be reimbursements to states where they help low-income children get access to health care. It's as simple as that. There's nothing more to this. This isn't some kind of complicated, semi-secret, dark government program. This is just to provide medical care to poor children, period.
That's correct. And part of that CHIP money was designated to help the state recoup money due to an increase in enrollment in CHIP, which they have almost all had, because premiums under the current insurance exchange are so unaffordable that many of their parents are going without insurance, and CHIP is the only way that their children can get medical care anymore.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because what you're talking about is $2 billion in CHIP funds that is specifically set aside for a program that helps states handle higher than expected enrollment. Just about every state in America has seen higher than expected enrollment, as you said a moment ago. But the White House issued a statement saying that they were projecting that no state will end up needing those funds because actual CHIP enrollment is going down and not up. But that's just simply not true, is it?
No, it's not true. It's not true at all. And it's just another example of their distortion of the facts. You know, they're in some separate reality. And the worst part is, and the reason this is probably going to be effective, is that people still actually believe them when they say these things.
Well, we have to organize, and one of the reasons I think this is such an important segment, we have to organize to tell the truth. We have to organize and mobilize and tell people the truth, because once people know the truth, and once they know that they've been lied to, it has a very, very big impact on their consciousness. One thing that, which is, you know, the Democrats are wanting to impeach or bring down Trump because of Russia collusion, they say, which, again, there's no proof of. We don't know of any yet. They want it because of Stormy Daniels or hush money, you know, all these kind of things. But here you have a guy, Donald Trump, maybe not as rich as he says he is, but still very, very, very rich. And all of his buddies in Congress, like Paul Ryan, want to take away health care from working class and poor children. Why isn't that the thing that they should be impeached for? Because that is such a gross violation of what they say their mission is, which is to represent the people of this country. I mean,
families.
Like like Bill Clinton could get impeached for, you know, Monica Lewinsky thing, but not for bombing Yugoslavia,
right?
Or bombing the one pharmaceutical in Sudan that produced anti-malarial drugs, which he bombed, by the way, on the day that he was supposed to testify about Monica Lewinsky.
That's right.
But yeah, the real crimes of the government are like not the crimes. The real crimes that they're accused of are something else. Go ahead, Mary.
Which is why shows like yours are so important, because it's the only way where we're really going to get the message out to people about the real crimes. I mean, let's face it, this isn't a matter of we don't like his morality. This is a matter of people are going to die because of this action. And it might as well be charged as a murder, but it won't be. And it won't be also because one of their other spins on this whole thing is that it really doesn't matter if they make this cut because these funds weren't used last year. Well, they weren't used last year partially because of the fact that there were more other safeguards in place to preserve CHIP and Medicaid, which have now are going by the wayside, especially with the advent of doing everything by block grants, which we all know that doesn't work, because when they give a block grant to a state or a city or municipal government, that governmental entity gets to decide how it's used. And sure, they've got to use some of it for what they say, but they use it administratively more than anything else. So we're still not getting the children the health care that they need to live.
Yeah, and that's the key. CHIP gives money for health care for children. Now, John, you mentioned the entire budget is about $15
billion. Right, just over $15
billion. And they're cutting...
$7
billion. So half,
right.
About half. Now, just to put it in perspective, this year alone, John, the government deficit will hit $804 billion. We're talking about a cut of $7 billion. You know why it's going to increase 21%?
I have one guess. It's an increase in defense spending.
And there's a second, and that's true. And there's a second, I'm going to give you a second guess.
Yeah, the Republican tax cuts.
Exactly.
You can't cut taxes and expect the money to magically appear for you to pay your bills.
So the government then goes deeper into debt by 21% in a single year as a consequence of these giveaways to the rich, either through the tax plan or the military spending, which is another giveaway to the rich, really. It's not about protecting America.
That's right.
And meanwhile, they're going to cut half the money for children's health. Because they have to?
No, not because they have to. Because it doesn't really matter to their budget or their budget plans. The impact that $7 billion is going to make on the overall budget, it's negligible at best. What isn't negligible is the children that are going to die. And, you know, it was interesting because, and I haven't seen statistics for about 3 years, but about 3 years ago, there were 30 people dying every 3 minutes in the United States for lack of health care. So during the time that we're listening to a half-hour program, 90 people would have died. Now, I don't know what those statistics are today, but I am betting that with cuts to CHIP and other Medicaid programs and things like that, they're going to go back up again. And that is just unimaginable.
Mary's not actually being hyperbolic or exaggerating.
No, not at all.
Kids are going to die.
Yeah.
Children will die. And, you know, we did that story last week, John, where one-third of all American households can't pay health care, food, and shelter. One-third. They can barely make it. Take away CHIP for kids. Some kids are going to die. Maybe a lot of kids.
Yes. That's what it comes down to. I regret that we're out of time, though. We were joined from Bennington, Vermont by Mary Garish. Mary is an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoyed the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. And now you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Love.